That's been great. I mean,
the screening kind of transcended any of our expectations. We were like thrilled with the way that it went. I mean, we were just absolutely, completely, 100% happy about how the audience reacted. The kind of questions we got and the questions and answers was just, everybody on the team was just very, very, very pleased.
What happened to the cat?
Well, that was a beautiful question, and ironically, it was the one question from a child, and I was so happy to receive that question because it shows exactly the way that children think, mm-hmm. and was exactly the way that Atticus thinks in the movie. I mean, he goes back to the house. The first thing he wants to do is feed the cat because he's got such connection to animals and to the world around him, and so. In a weird way, that questioner was actually giving me the most sublime compliment possible about the film. You know, as one child watching the reaction of another child, it was absolutely perfect. You
and
know?
The child has seen the importance of the scene, so it was very important for Atticus, so he identified with the character.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And there was another little girl who was about it was hard to tell. Maybe she was 13 or 14, and I was walking out, and I saw her, and I went up to her, and I asked her, what was your favorite part of the movie? And she, her English was not very good, but her sister was there and was translating for her, and she said, this scene with the deer. And I was like, wow, that's great, because that's Silas's favorite scene, you know, and because he got to touch a deer. That's literally why it's his favorite scene, because obviously in the forest, you don't ever get to touch a deer. They run away, you know. And so it was very interesting that both times I interacted with a child, it was both times about an animal, you know, which is great.
And the cat gets a TV show as well.
Okay. Yeah.
I was a little bit curious about, because you said during the Q&A, Atticus is a symbol for you for America. In which way?
Well, he's not really a symbol of America. I wanted to make a story about a boy, and you know, I always try to write as organically as possible. I don't question the story when I'm writing it. It's when I go back and I'm rewriting it or editing it that I start to think, well, what am I saying here? What is this really about? And I began to see so much kind of anxiety in the story, and so much kind of unsuredness, and so much of the story itself was dealing with things that are going on in America, like with the economy. I began to realize, oh, he seems like America to me, you know, and there's a history lesson in the beginning of the movie, and then there's the mother, and then all that kind of moves away, and then it's like kind of in this unsure middle ground in the forest, wondering where he's going to go, and then meets up with a guy who's making it all work and describes himself even as a small businessman and is kind of like, you know, very mobile and lives out of his car, and it's like, you know, I think America's trying to figure out where it's going to go now in a lot of ways, but I didn't set out to write that. I just, when I reflected upon the story, could see that that's probably where that idea was coming from. But I would never do something as obvious as, like, set out to make a movie about America. I mean, I don't think it's possible. You know?
There's one scene I like very much when Atticus and his mother are driving by these, what's it called? All these things in front of the house, take away whatever
like,
you want.
Like
the bee houses.
Yeah, the beehives.
Beehives.
Well, yeah, that's just, the house has been emptied and it's just rubbish on the street, and typically in small towns in the United States, they'll put up a sign that just says, you can take this, it's free. And, you know, it's usually the stage after a yard sale where people are actually trying to sell the stuff for money, and then this is the stuff that they can't get rid of, or they've had to move and this just left there. So, and you see that a lot, especially, you know, given the economy and the economic crisis in the States, you see a lot of houses for sale, and you see a lot of stuff that's just on the street because the people have left. And obviously there's a whole society of other people that are now going through that stuff and picking it up and making it theirs and living with that stuff. So
it's like the same, the special store where they use things. It's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you mean in the film, and when they go to the...
When Carter and Eddie...
Yeah, that's called... In the States, they call that a consignment shop. But yeah, it's all old stuff, used stuff, but that's the environment that they live in. You know, buying a bag of clothes for a dollar. You know, he's not going to the Armani store or whatever, and wouldn't even know what Armani was if he had the option, you know. And there's an entire strata of American society that lives that way, you know. And I live in this town, and I see it.
So what I could see in the movie was as well the different levels Atticus and his mother are talking on one side, because he says, what shall I give him as a birthday gift for his friend? He says, SpongeBob? At least something with zombies in it.
Right.
So you can see he's with his mother in the woods, but there are friends around. We can see them, but he's not isolated.
Well, also, I mean, you know, they don't have a television, and she gives him very limited access to the internet. But children will somehow, they somehow know what's going on culturally, whether it's he's, you know, flips through a magazine at the supermarket while she's shopping or whatever, but he knows who, like, Justin Bieber is, and he knows, you know, probably, you know, all the, like, what American Idol is. There's no way that you can avoid that in the United States. I mean, if you have a daughter, for example, and you don't have television, no matter what happens, that daughter is going to want a Barbie doll at 5 years old, no matter what. And you could do anything that you can to keep that idea away from your child, they will still find out. It's like, it's almost like a kind of, like a flu that goes through all of children. And so he's like any other child, and he wants these things. He wants to have DVDs. He wants to, you know, engage with other children who have these things. And despite the mother trying to keep him away from that, it's inevitable.
How was for you the writing process? You said the first time you write a story, you write the story. It's your story, and it comes. It sounds like I'm going to hide myself away and write my story till it's finished.
No, I mean, I actually call the first draft of every story the vomit draft, because you just something is compelling you to put these things down on paper. And I don't question why I'm doing those things. It's just let it come out. And then you go back and say, all right, this, what am I getting at? And what now, in retrospect, seems good or bad or appropriate for the story? And then you take out stuff and add stuff. And then slowly the story kind of emerges and you begin to realize what the story is saying to you. So I'm not really the kind of person that locks myself away for 5 weeks and you know, it's much more like I'll take 3 days and pitch everything down on a piece of paper and then think about it for like another 5 months. And we'll also talk to all of my friends. And most of my friends are artists in one, you know, either musicians or painters or you know, my girlfriend's a historian. Paul's wife is a photographer, you know, and I'll just say, I'm thinking about doing this, and then hear what they say and how they react to what I'm saying. They haven't read the paper. They only are just reacting to me, and then I'm like, oh, that's very interesting, and I start to apply that. And then I do that with the actors. I'll say to Lily, yeah, so this happens, and then she'll ask me a question, and I'll think, why is she asking that question? That must be something important about the character, and then I'll start writing that, you know. And I knew 8 months before we made the movie that Lily was going to play the mother, and so I would never specifically say to her, do you want to do this? We would just be talking, and then by the natural questions that she would ask, I would say, okay, that must be interesting. Let me look at that. And then take like a week and do that. And then, you know, so like every couple of months, I would sit down for like a week and just hammer something out. And then right before, about a month before we went into pre-production, I sat down and completely, very quickly hammered out a script.
Was it from the start obvious to you that there don't have to be a lot of dialogues in it, that it's very visual?
Yeah, well, I wanted to make it. I mean, I just, in general, my last film, which was called Spring Forward, is almost all dialogue. And I knew that I knew two things. I wanted to make, on a personal, selfish level, a film that didn't have so much dialogue. And B, I wanted to make a film that was well-crafted, but also vague enough that the audience could project whatever they wanted to on certain scenarios, and that those projections would make the audience think about the way that they look at the world or America. And the easiest way to do that is visually. As soon as you start getting dialogue involved, then it starts to get more specific, and the amount of interpretations that you can have about it become less and less.
Well, the second part of the movie, I say second part because right. After the mother, and it's starting to be a wood movie, road movie, I always had some fear, so don't sell him for $200.
Right.
Was it intended? Or
oh, absolutely. In fact, we had to de-emphasize that aspect of that section of the movie, because in the original script it was in there much more, that like forcing the people to think he's gonna turn the kid in for the money. But there are many of those kind of possibilities throughout the movie that you do or do not want to have happen to the child, and all of that is structured deliberately, that people, because I think, as we said before, it's a very anxious time right now for Americans, and so the overriding feeling in the film is anxiety about what will happen to this child, and that's one of the things that could happen, that this guy could turn him in, and he goes into the state system of, you know, group homes or, you know, orphanages or whatever, and that's not a good place for that child.
That's one of the things I was thinking. It's the best way at the end of the movie. It's a great ending. I don't tell the story now. But right. At the beginning, I got it right, that he burned a meth lab.
No, he didn't. But there was a meth lab in the forest, and this typically happens because they're strung out on drugs, that the meth explodes and causes a fire. And so he awakens in the forest, and there's all this smoke.
No, I thought Carter did
oh,
it.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, that's also deliberate, that you think Carter's one of the meth guys, but he actually isn't. He's...
Right. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Oh, you don't want to give the story.
My English is not good, but maybe what I wanted to say is I thought that Carter laid a fire in the meth lab, so he destroyed it.
Oh, interesting. No.
No?
No, Carter is much too peaceful for that.
Oh.
He would never... be that kind of violent or aggressive, or he's much more zen in his way that he moves through the world. Yeah, I mean, obviously he takes. I mean, there's a lot of Buddhist themes in the film, and Carter to me is a very zen character and moves through the world without trying to control it. Whereas, say, the mom is all about trying to control the world, and which many parents want to do because they're protective of their children, you know. And Carter is not about that. Carter's about moving through the world with as little conflict as possible, almost to be invisible.
And he has an interesting life. He has a lot to do to survive, but he doesn't steal.
No, he actually, everybody has to do what they can to live, but he actually has a very, very strong moral and ethical center to him, which is why he's the perfect person to be meeting this child. Certain people might look at him and think that he's a criminal, and certainly he is a criminal. But ethically and morally, he is beyond reproach in the movie. I mean, he has a complete moral code about what he will and will not do, does not violate it, and won't lie to the child, and won't steal, and... is just a very ethical person. And not only is he personally ethical, in the end of the movie, you can see that he's trying to inform the child of these ethics and teach the child that, you know, you have to be this way. This is a way to live in the world, not just whatever. You can't steal. You need to return this, you know. I think that's really, for him, that's the transitional moment in the film. It's like, it's no longer just about me. I now have this child, and so what do I bestow upon this child? And he says to the child in the car, "What do I owe you?" And he owes him his life, basically.
So when I think about some scenes, like when they are sleeping in this new-builder towers, when he has to be naked, mm-hmm. Your main character and Atticus, it was a very uncomfortable scene for both of them,
of course.
I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why it's there. And it's, again, to see what the audience is going to project on the man. Is he going to molest the kid, or you know, is the kid going to take off his clothes? Or, and you know, of course, you begin to find out as the story goes further, is that Carter's always taking off his clothes. He's skinny dipping, and he gets fired for taking his shirt off, and he's all about just being out in nature and just being very, very kind of wild, and it's very innocent. It's also incredibly inappropriate to do, but that the boy has no choice. He's under this guy's wing, no matter what happens, and the boy knows that, you know. And you know, Silas was very good about doing the scene, and his parents were, you know, they understood completely where it was coming from, and his mom was there, and you know, Peter is a wonderful actor and very brave man, you know, and everyone. you know, there was no rehearsal. It was just kind of, all right, here we go. And they did it, and Silas, you know, Silas knew what was going to happen. And all of the reactions that Silas gave it, they're all completely organic to him. I didn't tell him how to lay down. I didn't tell him what to do. He did all of that naturally, and obviously in the master shot, and then we copied it, you know, in the subsequent shots. But yeah, I mean, it's deliberately made. It's deliberately structured, so you should be uncomfortable.
Okay. So we could talk some more time. I would love that, but we need to stop now. So thanks for the interview. Enjoy your time in Berlin. But maybe one last thing. Is it already sold in Germany?
I don't know anything about the production or technical or distribution sides of the movie. That's all Paul, my partner, and this was our premiere. I mean, I literally finished the film like 2 days before Christmas, so everything is brand new, and I have no idea what's happening with it.
Okay.